Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Years ago, on a cold, dark night.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The annual Parade of Elephants is on in the music world, and they call them boxed sets. When the first CD boxed set, Eric Clapton's Crossroads, was released 25 years ago, the big music companies had a eureka moment and a quick way to turn a fat profit by glossing up, recycling, and repackaging catalogs, gathering dust on the shelves. Now, new technology is tweaking fresh shadings out of the old recordings as well. This year, in the stiff competition for the entertainment dollar, you'll see doorstoppers from Neil Diamond, Chicago, and Motorhead, plus never-before-seen DVDs to make a more enticing buy. But how much is too much, and where is the value add to the CDs you already own? Tonight, we asked two crack music critics in to help spot the cream of the crop, from Johnny Cash to the Buzzcocks. You'll get pointers for the sweetest gifts, and we'll hear some great music along the way. Tonight on Point, thinking through and out of the box set for the holidays.
Shed not a tear, but sometimes at night, when the cold wind moans.
Joining me in the studio is Tim Riley, music critic and author of Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary. Tim, good to have you back.
Hi, Tom.
And joining us from Philadelphia is Tom Moon, music critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Tom Moon, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
Tom, box sets, just first of all, what's your attitude toward them? They come out, they have an enormous volume, they stare at us off the shelves. Is this the archaeological vein of music? Do you sit with your box set and spend 4 days listening?
You can. And what's happened in the last couple of years is we've seen these labels that are really thinking about super serving the already rabid fans, so that in the case of, you know, say Johnny Cash, not only do we have the recordings that he made in the last 10 years of his life, but we also have this whole treasure trove, this box that's just come out called Unearthed, which is all stuff that wasn't released in his lifetime that he worked on while he was making those records. And anybody who cares deeply about Johnny Cash is going to want that stuff. In that case, there's a whole nother value-added disc, which is this the last recordings that he was really doing. This set of gospel songs called My Mother's Hymn Book. But in almost every genre and in almost every one of these sets, there's going to be something like that, some either rare gem or some other reason that the person who's already got a lot of, you know, Artist X in the catalog mm-hmm. will go.
We're going to hear some more Johnny Cash in just a moment. Many people are saying he's got the best box set of the season. But I want to get, Tim, from you the same question. When do you turn to the box sets? You're a music guy. You've already got shelves groaning with music. Why a box set? Do you ever pick them up, or is this purely a sucker's play?
Oh, no, I pick them up, and I think it's I agree with everything Tom Moon just said, but I think it's very easy. It's too easy to be cynical about all these things, and it's kind of a simplistic attitude. Mm-hmm. The argument that they're making money off of tapes that would otherwise just be sitting in the vaults. I mean, that's true, and yet the past is much more with us today in pop music, especially rock and roll, than it ever has been before. Mm-hmm. It's a much larger piece of the market. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I think that's kind of one of the things that happens when a style gets to be around 40, 50 years old. The past and the roots of everything that's going on in the current music-making scene tend to impinge more on the present. And that's just a natural progression of the way styles develop and the way that we start looking at history and trying to see what we can learn from it.
We're not going to throw Beethoven over, and we won't throw Johnny Cash over either.
But what the Johnny Cash box set proves is that Johnny Cash, in his, you know, what is it, sixth decade, was one of the most vital artists working in the 90s, and this box set just thrashes aesthetically a lot of other stuff that's current out there. So I think it's too easy to be cynical about the whole box set.
Well, then let's just dive in and enjoy it. Johnny Cash was working on this right up to the day he died. In fact, he died, what, September 12th, complications from diabetes. He was 71, and as I understand it, just the day before, he had heard and approved the final version of this 5-CD box set. Under the intro, we heard Long Black Veil, a traditional song performed there by Johnny Cash, of course. Let's dive back in and hear Johnny Cash here singing Hurt. Of course, this was written by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, also from Cash on Earth.
I hurt myself today.
to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears the hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend.
Tom Moon, there's something righteous in a box set for Johnny Cash, because the commercial world turned away from him for many years in the later years of his life. Here's a chance to go back and really savor a great artist.
Yeah, that's right. And in the case of these recordings he made with Rick Rubin starting in 1993, this was a reclamation project. Mr. Rubin told me that he felt like when they were making the first record, they weren't going to stop until Johnny Cash thought it was his best record.
Rick Rubin is known to many people as a hip-hop impresario. How did he get hooked up with Johnny Cash?
He was just a fan, and at a point where Johnny Cash didn't have a label and was really drifting, they met each other socially and I think quickly hit it off. And I think Johnny Cash was also mistrustful of many people in the record business from things that had happened to him years in the past. Hmm.
Tim Riley, on the disc 5 in this set is The Best of Cash on American. What about Johnny Cash's later work? This is material from his last 10 years or so.
Yeah, well, the last 10 years, Rick Rubin made 4 records with him. And he basically just brought him into the studio and said, you know, I'm a big fan, and I want you to sit down and play everything you know, and I want you to just accompany yourself on the guitar. And Cash was a little intimidated by this because he had never really accompanied himself before. He'd always had a backup band.
Well, I mean alone.
Just alone. Well, but
just,
not
just Johnny and his guitar.
Yeah, but to just play alone with your guitar in front of a microphone, that's a much more intimidating thing than walking into a Nashville session where you have all
nowhere
these,
to hide.
Well, all these pros sitting there who are just going to lay it down, and you can have a good vocal day or a bad vocal day. When it's all up to you, that's a much more challenging situation.
Right.
So, I mean, the marvel is really that Cash just sort of did sit down and play everything he knew, and they set the tape rolling for a long, long time. And those 4 records were culled from hundreds of hours of songs. And Cash says in the liner notes to the record that he was actually reminded of the days when he first met Sam Phillips in the Sun Studios in Memphis. And Sam Phillips just said, just play for me, just play for me. Everything you got, and we're going to find what the best material is for you.
All that in the box set. Tom, I hear you there.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that Rick did bring in rhythm sections, and several of the discs are with full bands and, you know, people like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and Flea from the Chili Peppers and other sort of rock-era folks. And even there, when they're working from something that was a Johnny Cash sketch with just guitar, you really feel like the band is completely with both feet in the room. Everybody's listening. Everybody's sort of on edge.
Let's turn to another classic right here. Bob Dylan's got the biggest box set that I've seen this season of. It's practically cubical. Let's jump right in before we hear what you guys have to say about it. Here's Like a Rolling Stone from Highway 61.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you people call, say, beware, doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal.
Technology is a big piece of the Bob Dylan box set, Tim Riley. What exactly have they brought to this?
Well, they've really perfected and advanced the remastering process. So that is, they're able to take these old tapes that were made on analog reel-to-reel tape recorders and update them digitally and bring more focus and presence to the sound than we've ever heard before. Now, they talk about it with a lot of different terms. They call it cleaning up, or they call it shaping the sound, or buffing up the sound.
SACD?
Yeah, the SACD.
What does that mean?
Well, we're into a new format war now. They're hoping to sell us new players that will reveal all of the sound, the new sound qualities they've developed.
You mean I can't even play this on my traditional CD player?
You can play it on your CD player,
yes.
But when you get your new SACD player, more will be revealed. So these are called hybrid discs. They have two different versions of the disc on the same disc. So if you own an SACD player, you're going to hear more. If you have a regular CD player, you're going to hear more. But they're hoping that this will help sell SACD players down the line.
And what do you hear, Tom Moon, when you hear this enhanced sound from Dylan?
Well, first of all, just with a normal CD Walkman type device, you do hear quite a bit of difference because the mastering process is so good, and they were so careful this time. The big tragedy of the beginning of the CD era, and Columbia Records is particularly guilty of this, is they put out very quickly these masters that did not capture all the audio. So you had very flat renditions of classic records like Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run, you know, Highway 61,
yeah,
all the early Dylan records. And now, finally, they're rectifying that. And that's one of if you're going to be cynical about the record business right now, that's one thing to be cynical about, is that here, you know, you almost do have to repurchase some of these classics because where the technology was in the beginning of the CD era in the 80s and where it is now is such a difference.
So different. We heard some very different early Dylan there. Let's get something much more recent from 2001 after a long dry spell. Here's Po' Boy from Love and Theft.
Man came to the door. I said, for whom are you looking? She says, your wife. I said, she's busy in the kitchen cooking. Poor boy, where you been? I already told you, won't tell you again. I say, how much you want for that? I go into the store. Man says, $3, all right. I say, well, you take four. Poor boy, never say die. Things will be all right by and by. Working like in a main line, working like a devil. The game is the same, it's just up on another level. Poor boy, dressed in black. Police at your back. Poor boy in a red hot town. Out beyond the twinkling stars.
Bob Dylan with that older sound, Tim. None of that juicy young boy there, even if he calls it Po' Boy.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I love about the way Dylan ran his sessions, and he ran these sessions a little bit differently than those early sessions, but he's still after a similar quality, which is he often would sing, he would go through the tune with his musicians in the studio and sing dummy lyrics or not sing the whole song,
mm-hmm,
just say, this is how the verse goes and here's the
more
chorus,
or less, yep,
and then we're out. And then, all right, let's do a take. And he preferred first or second takes.
Yeah.
All right, so what the fascinating thing that you can still hear on Like a Rolling Stone, and you can even hear it on Po' Boy, this more recent recording, is you hear the musicians hearing the song for the first time,
yeah,
as it goes down.
Right.
And they're learning what the song is about as they hear it sung.
So high marks for the Dylan box set, then?
Well, very high marks, yeah, because it's a classic.
It's basically everything.
Yeah.
Well, let's go out listening to a little bit of Code of Silence from Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. This is recorded live, 1999, from Rarities on the Essential Bruce Springsteen. Also, a Springsteen Live in Barcelona out now. Song about Amadou Diallo. Of course, here's a big, big, big collection of The Boss, Tom Moon.
Yeah. And it's another rarity set. Those who are fans probably bought the 4-CD box set called Tracks a couple years ago. So they might be scratching their heads about more rarities appearing now. But not only are the rarities well-rendered, but the classic stuff on the first two discs of the Essential Bruce Springsteen are tremendously improved over the original CD transfers.
And how did they do that?
Same thing. Just really spending a lot of time in the mastering process. Giving the tracks some headroom, giving them more bottom, firming up what was very fuzzy EQ in a lot of places.
Sounds like a good thing to listen to. We're sorting through sleigh loads of seasonal CD gift boxes tonight with Tim Riley and Tom Moon. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Counting on a miracle. Counting on a miracle. Counting on a miracle. I ain't no storybook story. Ain't no name
song. I happily ever after, ever come and gone, ever come and gone.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the gift of music, big music, box sets, and finding the best value, the best music out there. Behind me here is Led Zeppelin's Heartbreaker, recorded live in 1972. The 3-CD, 2-DVD set made a splash debut at number one on the Billboard album and video charts. We're talking tonight about box sets with Tim Riley and Tom Moon. Tom Moon of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Tim Riley, author of Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary. Let's listen to Led Zeppelin. Tim, Led Zeppelin, well, bringing up that, talk about the heavy bottom stuff. There's the Zeppelin.
There's no way we can sling enough superlatives at these sets that have, that Led Zeppelin have released this year. And there's something really wonderfully ironic and gratifying that they debut at number one. Although in a weird kind of way, they didn't get the attention they deserve for how good they are. The 3-CD.
You mean when they first came out?
No. When they haven't, these sets from Led Zeppelin have not come out till this year. Okay,
which
means
this is all previously unreleased.
Oh, okay. So Led Zeppelin's been sitting on this material for a long time.
Why?
And well, because they
just not a way, not the right agreement.
Yeah, you know, who knows? I think Led Zeppelin does a lot of withholding material to get more bang for the buck 20 years down the line. I don't know what you think about that, Tom. But
Tom? Do musicians have that kind of investment strategy, E.F. Hutton advising them?
They definitely do that. And there is the logic that says if you're scarce, they love you better when you do come back. And Zeppelin has been smart about their catalog. They did release a box set with all the studio albums, but there was no supplemental live material at that time, and this is the first like sort of new installment in the Led Zeppelin saga, and it's a huge one because many people who saw the live film, the Song Remains the Same, and maybe never got to see the band actually performing live, didn't get that film. Sort of psychedelic and weird, and has a lot of other stuff in it.
It's a terrible movie. But here you've got two DVDs in with the CDs
What
do you see?
Well, you see this band that was incredibly communicative among themselves, four guys who really understood how to play together, and you see them playing together in a way that seems almost impossible today. I mean, there's a sort of a group investment in what they do that I'm not sure that our present day sort of garage rock bands a la The Strokes have in them.
Now that's why is that? Was there a cultural context at the time where there were lots of models out there for that kind of close bonding?
Well, don't you think part of it is just that these guys were not that far removed from the thrill of collective jazz improvisation?
Yeah.
And Jimmy Page had the experience of, you know, sitting there and hearing whoever, you know, Archie Shepp or, you know, and really understanding what Miles Davis was doing in 1970 and 1971. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that's that sort of group investment does come out of the jazz world a little bit.
And Tim, what about the time travel element here? How much of Led Zeppelin's rock and roll influence do you still hear coursing through the music that's, you know, coming out today?
Oh, a ton. I mean, I think a band like Pearl Jam has been, you know, owes a huge debt to Led Zeppelin. The other thing
White
I like
Stripes.
White Stripes, definitely. The other thing I like about this Zeppelin DVD set, though, is that it captures them at three different signal points throughout their career. You get them early on at the Albert Hall in 1970. You get them at Madison Square Garden in 1973. So early on, you see these young hippies with a very kind of lackadaisical stage style. A mere 3 years later, they're on top of the world. They are the biggest stars in rock and roll,
yeah.
And they play in this fancy regalia and everything. And yet the commitment and focus and passion to the music is still very intense. And then you see them at the end in 1979 at the Knebworth Festival, which is one of their last major appearances. And they're playing very late material, much more intricate material. They've advanced and progressed. The music has gotten much more complex and sophisticated. And they're still playing with this rabid rabid passion and enthusiasm. It's really something to see.
So the DVD really does enhance the experience of the box set.
Especially
here.
Because now you can watch it and hear it at this wonderful fidelity and watch it at the same time.
This may be a technically foolish question, but is the sound quality that accompanies the DVD the same as that on the CD? Can you hook it all up to your stereo and have the same experience?
That's what I'm trying
Just
to
about.
Say.
Yeah. Some of the live stuff on the live 3-disc audio, How the West Was Won, mm-hmm. is a little bit clearer to my ear than the stuff on the DVD, but it's pretty close. And if you have a decent sort of home theater situation, you will definitely experience Zeppelin as they sounded live.
So it sounds like a big thumbs up here also for Led Zeppelin, How the West Was Won. Let's jump just a little further ahead in time to the Buzzcocks, Howard Devoto. Let's listen to just a little bit here of Boredom from No Thanks, a 4-volume set of punk. Tom Moon, here's a history lesson. We move right along from Led Zeppelin to the Buzzcocks, and this is, of course, Howard Devoto's there, but there are all kinds of punk artists in this box set, aren't there?
Yeah, what Rhino does really well, Rhino is this label based mm-hmm. in L.A. that mm-hmm. has, for the last 10 or so years, really tried to focus attention on genres as much. They'll do box sets on individual artists, but when they sit and try and sort of call the best of, in this case, punk, they really come up with the representative history lesson. And what's amazing about this set is you get the New York Dolls and some of the obvious choices, and you also get the Pretenders and some things that you wouldn't think of or necessarily associate quickly with punk.
Now this cut, Boredom, Tim, was recorded, what, just 10 months or so after the Sex Pistols famous Manchester show. Howard Devoto and Pete Shelley, heard it, saw it, started the Buzzcocks, and boom.
Well, it's a very important tour that the Sex Pistols take of Britain in 1976, and they ignite all over the country, virtually everywhere they go. Most of the members of their audience instantly form bands and go out and join the punk movement, and the Buzzcocks being the most famous there from Manchester. This is one of the it's previously available only on a British EP, I believe, so mm-hmm. people who are punk collectors will be glad to see it show up on this box
set. And why is the box set called No Thanks! Exclamation mark?
Well, my understanding was that they sent out all the copyright permissions to get approval for the song sequence they had selected, and the only people who turned them down were the Sex Pistols, and the Sex Pistols sent them a 2-word telegram just saying no thanks.
Tom Moon, I'm struck by how tame this sounds now. I mean, it was so upsetting to people in the 70s, incendiary, just mind-bending and disturbing, and now it's the soundtrack for car commercials.
I don't know. There's still some mind-bending and disturbing stuff on there, and great playing and things that you didn't necessarily associate with punk at the time. When you hear Television, for example, the great New York band, now in the context, particularly in the context of this box, where they're with many bands whose level of technical proficiency was far less than theirs, they really stand out. You really feel that these guys had a conception for how to play the guitar and how to make it feel like punk, but also have a certain refinement to it.
Tim, you've got a great quote from Gril Marcus.
Oh, well, one of the more insightful things that were ever said about punk, I would say, was what Gril Marcus said, that, it started out as being a way of trying to kill off rock and roll. Mm-hmm. These people were all angry at the excess and the pretension that Led Zeppelin signified, for example. And then punk wound up being the only way rock and roll could save itself, which was simply to divest itself of all of that grandiosity and pretension and get back to just high-energy music making that had nothing to do with virtuosity and nothing to do with pretension.
And just the raw stuff. Let's move one step ahead in that progression. Here is Talking Heads with their box set. Here's Once in a Lifetime.
And you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may find yourself in another part of the world. And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Letting the chaos
And there's the Talking Heads. What do you think of this box set, Tom Moon? Is it high on your list?
It's not high on my list. It's about midway down. First of all, it's packaged in just an obnoxious thing that no one's ever going to be able to file. It's about 2.5 feet long.
Oh, my gosh.
And a thin folio. It looks like it's about the size and dimension of those clappers that they have at sporting events sometimes, those foam things. And a real handy
slide into your CD shelf.
Yeah, right. It'll fit right next to, you know, Paul Simon Graceland or whatever.
Yeah.
But it also has some indulgent sort of commentary in the, some of these boxes, they really do write a history into the liner notes, and they attempted to do that here, and some of the David Byrne stuff is, you just scratch your head at a little bit. Audio-wise, it's really good. It's an improvement over the 2-CD anthology, Sand and the Vaseline, that came out several years ago. But the biggest thing that I think is going for this one is the DVD, which collects a bunch of the videos, which, of course, are a huge part of the story with Talking Heads.
Tim Riley, this was the band that every grad student in the 1980s loved or had to love. Maybe the packaging is too big here, but when you listen back to the Talking Heads now, how does it strike you?
Well, I've always thought the Talking Heads were really important for their merging of two different sensibilities. One is a new wave, sort of an intellectual punk sensibility, and the other is the art school sensibility, which brings a whole kind of visual element to the sound itself. And so David Byrne doesn't write songs as kind of through narratives the way, say, Lennon McCartney did. Mm-hmm. David Byrne writes songs as though he were painting things. Mm-hmm. So you'll get one stretch of song that has one color, and then he'll immediately change to a whole new color for a song. And it's a very kind of painterly visual approach to the whole craft of songwriting, and that's what makes Stop Making Sense one of the better films, is that their whole stage show was a very visual thing. You really could say, you know, you haven't experienced all that television has to offer until you see them conceive that music visually for video or on stage.
Speaking of painterly, on the ballad side of things, Joni Mitchell has a big box set out now. I don't know if either of you have dived into this. Have you had a chance, Tim?
I haven't. No.
Tom Moon?
Just briefly looked at it, haven't heard any of it.
Let's listen just a little bit. Here's Amelia from Joni Mitchell's new box set.
I was driving across the burning desert when I spotted 6 jet planes leaving 6 white vapor trails across the bleak terrain. It was the hexagram of the heavens. It was the strings of my guitar. Amelia, it was just a false alarm.
I'm a fan of her.
I adore Joni Mitchell. I'm just embarrassed to say I've been working through so many box sets recently that I didn't get to hers. Hers, I'm sure, is wonderful. If they've done any kind of sonic improvement, the addition to Hijera that I own, which had been remastered as of a couple of years ago, sounds great. So if they've been able to improve it since then, I'm sure it's wonderful.
So are we really hearing from you guys tonight that if you've got a decent sound system, that the new technology coming out makes it worthwhile to invest in a new generation of discs on the shelf?
You're going to hear a difference, and it is kind of the consumer gets sucker punched here. The consumer loses out because they did release CDs basically before they were ready. But it's kind of analogous to the computer.
Yeah, we wanted them then, too. We didn't want to wait for 10 years.
We wanted them. We didn't want to wait. And now you'd look at a computer that you would buy 10 years ago, and you would laugh.
Mm-hmm.
You would say, there's no way I could buy that now. Well, that's kind of the way that's turning out. With the pace of technology and the advancements they've made in audio technology, that's kind of the way the consumer gets hit these days.
But these are big investments, Tom. I mean, we've got everything here from, I don't know, $20, $30 right up to Bob Dylan's, what is it, $199.99?
Sure.
I call that $200. That's a lot of dough.
Sure. And, you know, there are now 6 or 7 Miles Davis box sets, for example, each one many discs and representing a chunk of money.
Is this pure marketing manipulation or is there some new facet that's ideally shown each time out?
Well, in addition to what Tim was saying about the Sonics, often this stuff that doesn't come out initially. In the case of Joni, maybe there might only be four or five tracks that we don't know from her records that are new. In the case of this Jack Johnson Miles Davis set, there's basically hours and hours of music that was made live in the studio that was culled together and edited by T.O. Macero, the producer of that record. And what you get when you hear the box set is the sort of full canvas, exactly everything that they were doing and what was pulled from. And
So plenty of value there. We're going to hear some more from Miles. I want to talk about one. It's not exactly a box set, but we'll pull it into this conversation. It's the Jimi Hendrix release. And we're talking about it tonight because of the DVD that's thrown in. I mean, I don't know if it qualifies as a box set, but it's, let's listen a bit. Here's Machine Gun from Jimmy Plays Berkeley. Jimi Hendrix, this is off a DVD of a live show at the Berklee Community Theater on May 30th, 1970, just 4 months before Jimi Hendrix's death from a drug overdose. Tom Moon, what do you make of it?
It's tremendous. And once again, we're hearing some. This adds just maybe a small piece to the discography, but it gives us just another glimpse of Jimi Hendrix. And he's one of those artists that you cannot sort of have too much of. And not to say that every performance is worth, you know, elaborate DVD packaging and separate audio. But when you get these performances that are like that, that have that energy to them, and document something that's important, that sort of fills in a gap, however big or small, I think they're important it's important work. You know, if you think of record making and the releasing of records as a bit of cultural custodianship, mm-hmm. then you need to, you know, it's important for us to have the small things that sort of fall in between the large releases that we all know and love.
Not to mention, Tim Riley, that this intersects the whole boom in home theaters like crazy. I mean, that's who's going to step up and buy this, right?
Well, exactly. And that's what they're exploiting with these DVDs, which are often included in the box set. Or now you'll pick up CDs that'll have a bonus DVD in them just to drive the sales of the CD, to make sure you don't rip the CD off the web, that you buy it in the store. You'll get a DVD alongside it. I agree with Tom about the Jimi Hendrix. I mean, there's never going to be enough Jimi Hendrix for my taste. Every single morsel that they dish out for you, it's revelatory. I mean, you cannot. If you're a guitar player, for example, you are never going to stop learning from this guy. I mean, there are guitar players now who have a whole new textbook that they can sit and study. This guy did not play the same concert two times in a row ever. He would play the same set list, and he would always rearrange what he was playing.
Let's hear some more Jimi Hendrix. We're talking with Tim Riley and Tom Moon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Well, I'll pick up my axe and fight like a farmer. I said I'll pick up my axe and fight like a farmer. But your bullets still knock me down in the ground.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the best sounds and the best buys in the CD gift box market this season. In the background, the electrified sound that broke ground from Miles Davis in 1971. This is Willie Nelson Take Two from Miles Davis, the complete Jack Johnson sessions. Tom Moon, this one's got you fired up.
Oh, I love this. What's happened in the last few years as they've brought out these individual sets about Miles, they did one on the Bridget Bruce sessions the same way, is that you realize that it wasn't just one day in the studio or several days, that these guys were churning out very highly different kinds of jazz fusion or jazz rock fusion, whatever you want to call it, improvisation. And the producer, Tio Macero, was picking, sort of cherry-picking moments out of these long, vastly long performances, often 15, 16 minutes, and stringing them together into something tighter, which are all beautiful on their own, and they stand the test, and, you know, it's not like a case of cut and paste going awry.
But that means this material is from the cutting room floor, so to speak?
Well, this is the material from which Tio pulled. In other words, they didn't cut and then leave a hole. This is the whole entire master take, so to speak.
And I don't follow all the names here. Willie Nelson, Jack Johnson. Now, Jack Johnson was a boxer. How does that come in, Tim Riley?
Well, Jack Johnson was a boxer around the turn of the century who lived a hard, fast lifestyle, and Miles Davis always revered him and admired him and felt like he was a prime example of how the black professional in our culture has to work three times as hard to get the same amount of respect as a white professional.
So this was a soundtrack for a documentary
For a documentary, which is apparently long forgotten. But he made this music to show his affection for Jack Johnson and to be the soundtrack for this movie. But it wound up being transcending that whole project and becoming much more important for its own part. I mean, my own experience with this music is that it was the very first jazz that really turned me on, and that's because he was hanging out with Sly Stone, and he was listening to Jimi Hendrix, and he was really sort of envious of the concert scene that he was seeing those people enjoy, and he wanted a piece of that action, both in terms of the money, but also just in terms of the energy and the rhythm.
And where does Willie Nelson come into this?
Well, that's just a joke title. That's just him saying, all right, we got a jam session here. We don't know what to call it. I'm just going to call it Willie Nelson. That's just a joke.
Okay, great. Let's catch just a little bit of one more box set, a great one. The Count Basie Band. Here's Swing, Brother, Swing.
Deep rhythm captivates me. Hot rhythm stimulates me. Can't help but swing it, boy. Swing it, brother, swing. Don't stop to diddle-daddle. Stop this foolish prattle. Come on, swing me, gate. Swing it, brother, swing. Ready to go, and there ain't nobody gonna hold me down. Say, listen, Bo, hurry up and send me, let me go to town. Stop this diddle-daddle and this foolish prattle. Come on, kill me, Joe. Swing it, brother, swing.
And you will, I hope, recognize there Billie Holiday on vocals. This is from America's number one band, recorded June 30th, 1937. And Tom Moon, just the fact that we can hear these two together, Count Basie and Billie Holiday, I guess, is something of a revelation even now.
Yeah, and again, sound quality much improved over what we might have expected even a few years ago. That's the thing about a lot of these jazz sets. This Charlie Parker Complete Verve is the same way, even though it is not actually the Complete Verve. There are a couple things missing. The quality of it, and particularly the stuff that we know of as Bird with Strings, is incredibly precise. And similarly with this big band, of Basie's does not sound like it's coming to you from the 1930s at all. It's very crisp.
And I guess it couldn't have come in the 1930s, Tim, because what Basie and Billie Holiday had different labels. They weren't recording together.
Yeah, I believe this is a radio performance.
I think from a live radio performance, it was recorded but not released.
Right, so they wouldn't have been able to put out a record with both their names because they were under contract to different people. But she was known for appearing with big bands, and she was friendly with all these people that were out touring, and she'd be happy to sit in with the Count Basie Band anytime she could. So, yeah, this is one of the rare times we get to hear with Count Basie.
I guess another advantage of the box set is that they can pull up all this kind of arcania, whether it's old video footage that they give you now on DVD, whether it's the material in these quite fabulous books, mini encyclopedias that go along with some of these box sets, and certainly the music. I mean, there's room to let you hear it.
Think of, like, film restoration. Think of all the advancements they've made in putting some of those old films together and cleaning up the picture and making the sound that much better and giving whole new audiences a whole fresh perspective on, you know, the art of filmmaking was really advanced in the 20s and 30s, but we didn't think of it that way because most of the films that we got shown were on, you know, the film had aged and the stock was that great, and it looks kind of scrappy. When you're able to restore it fully and it has real high fidelity, you get that much more excited about it.
There is a great experience. We're going to go out tonight with the Count Basie Band doing the 1 o'clock jump. Tim Riley, thanks so much for joining us with your favorites this season. Tim Riley is music writer and author of Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary, and the forthcoming Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. And Tom Moon in Philadelphia, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you.
Tom Moon is music critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer and a frequent contributor to the Rolling Stone and NPR. Here's Count Basie, 1 o'clock jump. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
One candidate clearly now stands out. And so I'm asking all of you to join in this grassroots movement to elect Howard Dean President of the United States. Thank you.
Al Gore is endorsing somebody who has taken positions in this campaign that are diametrically opposite to what Al himself has said he believed in over the years.
We're now showing widespread influenza activity in 24 states. All jurisdictions are reporting flu, and it's clear that the epidemic has not peaked this year.
Circled by reporters, Congressman Janklow left the courthouse without speaking. Prosecutor packed up his briefcase and also left without a word. The victim's mother, Marcella Scott, was also tight-lipped, wiping away tears as she walked down the courthouse steps.
What the appellate court has tried to say is you better be darn careful if you're going to start putting 12 and 13-year-olds on trial for first-degree murder in adult court. I'm just so happy for Lionel and his mother and everybody that's worked so hard to get this child a fair shake.
Our people risk their lives. A friendly coalition of folks risk their lives, and therefore the contracting is going to reflect that. And that's what the U.S. taxpayers expect.
The Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to a woman from Iran. Undoubtedly, my selection will be an inspiration to the masses of women.
We heard the explosion at 10 to 11. I'm a security guard in a shop nearby. I saw a car there, a Mercedes, broken glass around. One body was lying by it. Another was lying in the road.
In my candidacy, people and their needs come before everything else.
A lot of people who voted for Ronald Reagan voted for Paul Simon. There was not much of a philosophical link there, except Paul Simon exuded a kind of integrity, and so you had people voting Reagan-Simon.
Under Republican control, we have gone, I believe in 1994, from about 2,000 earmarks per year to over 10,000.
$2 million to encourage young people to play golf. $500,000 for halibut data collection.
$50 million to build an indoor rainforest. $90,000 for fruit fly research. $75,000 for a North Pole transit system.
$180,000 for seafood waste research. $500,000 for a bike path in St. Petersburg, Florida.
$2 million for the First Tee program in St. Augustine, Florida.
$450,000 for the Johnny Appleseed Heritage Center.
$90,000 for audio equipment at the Cowgirl Hall of Fame.
Whoa. Al Gore endorses Howard Dean in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination there. At least 24 states are hit hard by a feisty flu virus. At least 11 children have already died at the start of this year's flu season. South Dakota Congressman Bill Janklo resigns after being found guilty of second-degree manslaughter in a highway death. The Florida appeals court throws out the life sentence against teenager Lionel Tate. In 1999, then 12-year-old Tate was found guilty of murdering a 6-year-old girl. President Bush defends the administration's decision to award Iraq reconstruction contracts exclusively to coalition member nations. Iranian human rights activist Shirin Ebadi collects the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize. A Chechen rebel kills herself and five others in a suicide bombing in central Moscow. Former Illinois Senator Paul Simon dies at age 75. And the House passes an $820 billion omnibus spending bill. You heard GOP Congressman Jeff Flake there blasting his fellow Republicans for the thousands of pork barrel earmarks contained in the bill. And the Dow breaks 10,000. There we are, Jack, another week.
Another week. And, you know, the Hooters Corporation, which wants to open a store, a bar in Shreveport, Louisiana, came a step closer to doing that thanks to that omnibus bill. It provides some funding for that.
National priorities, Jack. National priorities.
I think we have to look after our priorities. And speaking of priorities, we had a very important Supreme Court decision this week on the campaign finance law upholding its constitutionality. And in their majority opinion, Justices O'Connor and Stevens referred to, quote, reams of disquieting evidence demonstrating that parties have sold access to federal candidates and office holders. They're speaking, of course, about mm-hmm. the influence of unregulated soft money. And, you know, looking at the current menu of legislation just passed or now pending in the Congress, you can almost apply that reams of disquieting evidence rubric to it. Take the Medicare drug benefit, for example. $25 million from the drug companies contributed in the last 2002 political cycle, two-thirds of it to the GOP. $15 million from insurance companies, again, mostly to the GOP, $25 million from the AMA, again, mostly to the GOP. And today we learned from the Washington Post that the company that's going to manage the benefit until the full benefit takes control, begins in 2006, turns out that's an Austin, Texas company, the owner of which is a friend of the president. The energy bill, well, from big oil, big gas, big nuke, all kinds of money, again, mostly to GOP candidates. The New York Times front page story refers to the 50 power plants in the Midwest that were given a leave on the Clean Air Act, heavy contributors to the GOP. And in Iraq, $50 million. That's the amount that the companies that got the contracts there have paid to, again, mostly GOP, but also Democrats since 1991.
So plenty of money.
Reams of disquieting evidence, I would say.
And the court not afraid to point at it this week and say to Congress, hey, you're free to do something about it. And an old standby, Paul Simon, gone this week at age 75, Jack.
What a decent man. You know, you can say one thing for sure. This is the last person who will have written a biography of Lincoln ever to serve in the United States Senate. Not only 20 other books, 55 honorary degrees, an honorable man. He used to say, we can do better. And when you looked at him, you thought, you know, we are a democracy, obviously, and everybody is fundamentally equal. And yet there are differences in personal quality. And you only had to look at this son of a Lutheran minister to read about his background to see that this was a man of immense personal quality. He lived by the banks of the Sangamon River, mm-hmm. and of course that's where Lincoln in 1830 splits 3,000 rails, and he was imbued with the best features of Illinois politics, the scholarly turn, and also the homey touch. He'll be missed. He was a fine, fine public servant.
No Armani suits for Senator Paul Simon.
Yeah, he said I have a face made for radio.
Yeah, and always a great bow tie right beneath it. We will remember him fondly. Jack, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.